From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Ogden Nash established his reputation with poetry, not biology, and yet we can't resist introducing this next scientific story with a few lines of Nash's verse. Take it away, Melissa.
Here we go. I like the duck-billed platypus because it is anomalous. I like the way it raises its family, partly birdly, partly mammally. I like its independent attitude. Let no one call it a duck-billed platitude.
Actually, that's pretty accurate. Scientists have now completed a draft DNA sequence of the platypus genome, and as NPR's Joe Palco reports, the platypus is, in fact, partly birdly, partly mammally.
The platypus is definitely unusual, not just because it only lives in Australia. Richard Wilson directed the Platypus Genome Project at Washington University in St. Louis.
When the first specimens were brought back to England in the 18th century, most of the naturalists that looked at them thought that they were some sort of a fake. A taxidermist had gotten creative and sewn the bill of a duck on some sort of beaver-like creature and added webbed feet for grins.
But the platypus is, of course, real, even if its genome is a bit strange. Most genes in the platypus make things typical of mammals, genes for fur, genes for making milk. But unlike most mammals, the platypus lays eggs. And as Wilson reports in this week's issue of the journal Nature, the platypus has the same genes birds have for making hard-shelled eggs. And that's not the only odd thing.
They also have very bizarre sex chromosomes.
Wilson says the sex chromosomes of platypuses, yes, I checked, it's platypuses, are more like the sex chromosomes of birds.
A male platypus has 5 X chromosomes, no two alike, and 5 Y chromosomes.
In addition to bird and mammal-like genes, the platypus also has reptile-like genes. Male platypuses make a kind of venom that they transmit using a spur on their hind legs. Jerry Siegel is a neuroscientist at UCLA who's studied the platypus. He says you really want to steer clear of this venom.
It causes intractable pain, which lasts for months. There's some thought that this is used primarily in mating rather than predation.
Mating? That doesn't sound like any fun.
It doesn't sound like fun for the Métis, but they've been around for a long time, so it must work. They, like a bad marriage, you know, they've worked out a relationship.
Siegel says the platypus can tell us a lot about how animals evolved. That's because platypuses split off from the rest of the mammal line more than 150 million years ago. So if a platypus has a particular trait, you know it's an ancient mammalian trait, not something that showed up more recently. Take REM sleep. Siegel says some scientists argued that REM sleep only evolved after mammals got bigger brains. So Siegel studied sleeping platypuses.
And what we saw is that in the platypus, the REM sleep is absolutely unequivocal.
Meaning mammals had REM sleep long before our bulging brains evolved. The platypus is just one of many species that are currently having their genomes probed, but geneticist Richard Wilson says there are still plenty of gaps in the genetic record that scientists would like to fill.
If we think about the platypus and the chicken, there's a couple hundred million years of evolution in between. So you'd like to sequence things in between.
That's not a problem. Ogden Nash has written poems about lots of animals. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
And if you're curious, you can see a video of a platypus swimming and sleeping. That's at our website, npr.org.
Horses bred for speed are much on the mind of our sports commentator, Frank DeFord. He's been thinking of last weekend's Kentucky Derby, where the horse 8 Bells broke both front ankles and was euthanized.
More and more sport, especially in the United States, is reduced to speed and power. Not always, of course, the very nature of sport. Its elemental base has been who's the fastest or who's the strongest. But guile and gumption used to play a larger part in our games. No one knows what killed the filly 8 Bells after the Kentucky Derby last Saturday. She looked just fine to the very moment she keeled over. It was like those sad little two-sentence notices you read in the newspaper every once in a while and then forget about some apparently healthy high school or college athlete who just suddenly, mysteriously collapses and dies at practice. The difference with 8 Bells, though, is that she did it in the glare of her sport's largest audience. Had she died after the 5th race one Thursday afternoon at Suffolk Downs, no one would have paid much attention. But, of course, horse racing has been cursed that all too often the everyday tragedy has struck at its premier events. It is sufficient only to cite two names, Ruffian, Barbaro. So the search is on for immediate villains. Was it the hard dirt track? Did her trainer use gross misjudgment in pitting a brave girl against 19 boys? PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, wants to suspend the jockey, presumably for not being clairvoyant about his mount's condition. But the fact is, we will probably never really know. Thoroughbreds are such incredibly fragile creatures, half-ton beasts born with a burning desire to run, doing so on candlestick legs. There is an old Bedouin legend that best describes how wispy they really are. And God took a handful of southerly wind, blew his breath over it, and created the horse. But our mania for speed has made these great delicate beasts all the more brittle. All 20 horses in the Derby were descended from one great sire, the magnificent gray native dancer who lived but a half century ago. Add to this inbreeding the fact that drugs are allowed today in the United States that are banned most elsewhere, so that horses who have no business racing do, and then they go to stud and pass on their weaknesses. Speed, speed. European horses run more tactical races. We just go flat out. Maybe the closest thing in sport to a thoroughbred's legs is a baseball pitcher's arm. The scouts yearn only for the arms that can throw the hardest, and kid pitchers break down all the time. Young female athletes thrown into the fray are suffering a plague of ACL injuries. Likewise, tennis players of both sexes are walking wounded on the hard courts they pound on, their arms torn by the torque of hitting so hard with synthetic rackets. Football ball carriers, who routinely weigh more than what linemen used to, run faster than ever. Too many of their bodies give out too soon. Speed, power, faster, stronger. Eight Bells was a horse, but also, really, she was one of us.
Commentary from Frank DeFord, who is one of us. He joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU, Fairfield, Connecticut. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Renee's back with us tomorrow. I'm Steve Inskeep. In Afghanistan, outsiders are working with the government to create something that has never existed before in this country, a national park. It's a 220-square-mile site. It's hard to get to. It takes several hours by four-wheel drive vehicle on rocky roads that wind through mountains and across streams. But the drive is easy compared to the obstacles that planners face to make this park a reality. NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson recently visited the remote site in central Bamyan province.
Between 10,000-foot-tall mountains in the Hindu Kush range lie six sky-blue lakes. They are the lifeline of 15 villages where people live pretty much as they have for centuries. The lake region and its many streams, called Banda Amir, boast some of the most beautiful landscape in Afghanistan. Like these crystal-clear waterfalls cascading over naturally formed dams that keep the lakes in place. Such natural wonders make Banda Amir the perfect place to create Afghanistan's first national park, says Bamyan Governor Habiba Surabi.
This is one of our desires, one of our wish that at least we will have something for the tourism attraction or tourism destination for in Bamyan.
Surabi and other Afghan officials have joined forces with the Wildlife Conservation Society, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and other foreign donors to make the park a reality, not just as a tourist haven, but as a place where the country's fledgling conservation laws can take root. A planned paved road will make Banda Amir more accessible, although it could take years to build. Lauren Stoddard is USAID's Director of Alternative Development and Agriculture Office in Afghanistan.
There was just kind of a sense within the donor community as well as the government that this particular piece of natural resource was something that was so attractive, desirable, and generally worthy of protection that it needed to be sort of made an example of.
But standing here, you can already see what some of the problem is with creating a national park. There are animal droppings everywhere, plastic bags that are discarded, flutter about in the wind. There are also empty bottles that are littering the area.
Salam alaikum.
Salam alaikum.
Inja chikar mikuni?
Astavanas.
Syed Hussein runs a flour mill built three generations ago next to some of the waterfalls at one of the lakes. The 60-year-old is one of many villagers who are nervous about the proposed park. To him and many others across Afghanistan, conserving natural resources is a foreign concept. Natural resources are what they depend on to survive. Trees are cut down for firewood. Landscapes are turned into farmland and pastures to grow food and raise livestock. Trash is hauled to the edges of one's neighborhood to be dumped or burned. Water is harnessed for consumption and power. So to Syed Hussein, the waterfalls next to his mill aren't something beautiful to be gawked at. They are a way to power the heavy stone wheels that grind wheat into flour. He is reluctant to consider how he might change his life to make the park work. Not take donkeys to drink and graze at the lake so that wildlife might return? Forget it, he says. The animals are the only way to transport his flour. Move the mill? Impossible, he says. How would he power it? But villagers do get a say in what happens here. Decisions about the proposed park and its rules are in the hands of a committee that includes not only the government in Kabul, but Banda Amir elders and other village representatives. Peter Smallwood, who is country director of the Wildlife Conservation Society, says the aim is for the park to be a homegrown one, a national landmark that benefits residents and tourists.
I don't think that our job here is to recreate an American park. And in fact, other than gentle nudges, I don't really want to be saying, here is the vision. You know, I want the vision to grow from theirs.
So the park will have some features one doesn't usually see in the West, like a Shiite Muslim shrine on one lakefront that will remain open. Even so, the committee's ideas on creating this park aren't necessarily popular with residents. Some accuse the Asian Development Bank, which built the park's first ranger station, of failing to pay the owner for the land. Others complain that the committee has yet to come up with a new location for the marketplace that was moved from the lakefront area last fall. A local teacher, Roria, says that park planners should also hurry up with a plan for the herders of sheep, goats, and other livestock who take their flocks to the lakes to drink and graze on nearby mountainsides.
Our entire livelihood depends on farming and livestock, but no one, not the government nor the committee, has given us any real assurance with regards to how we can continue living here.
American proponents of the park say those decisions must come from the Afghans themselves. Smallwood of the Wildlife Conservation Society admits it's slow going, like getting the Afghan government to establish a general set of rules for protected areas. That's the last hurdle before the park officially opens. With the ongoing war against the Taliban elsewhere in the country, he and others say it's hard to get the government to focus on protecting the environment. Banda Amir Park Ranger Syed Zahir says he and the other three rangers assigned here have not been paid in 4 months since the government took charge of them from the Wildlife Conservation Society. But he adds that he believes in what he has been hired to do and that he's having some success in getting fellow Banda Amir residents to cooperate with conservation measures, like persuading them not to hunt or fish, nor allowing their sheep and cattle to spend too much time at the lakes. Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Banda Amir.
Looking at a photograph of some of these waters in Afghanistan, hard to believe that water can be that blue. You can get a look at an audio slideshow of this proposed national park in Afghanistan by going to npr.org.
Yesterday, we reported on a construction project that could redefine the Las Vegas Strip, the $8 billion city center. It's bringing some of the world's most famous architects to the Strip. Well, today we return to Vegas to hear about the ambitious environmental goals of City Center. The development is trying to follow green building standards, what are called LEED standards, to be precise. But as NPR's Ted Robbins reports, some say getting LEED certification is not worth the cost.
Standing in the midst of construction for the City Center project on the Las Vegas Strip, it's hard to imagine it's conserving anything. 76 acres of soaring and curving hotels, condos, shopping and entertainment space in the desert. But Cindy Ortega touts its sustainability. She is VP of Energy and Environmental Services for MGM Mirage, which owns City Center.
It's beautiful, isn't it? See the curvature of the steel? Now, the reason why this is environmental, you see this guy welding this steel right here? Steel is 95% recycled.
Actually, using recycled steel is common practice. Steel is the most recycled material on the planet. But City Center is even recycling construction waste, including the concrete left over when the old Boardwalk Casino was blown up to make way for the new development.
So instead of hauling it away out to some pile out in the hills out here, we crushed it up on site and reused it for the roads here.
The goal is a green development. The proof is LEED certification. Bill Browning is a founding member of the U.S. Green Building Council, which administers LEED. He helped write the standards.
In the early 90s, we didn't have a good way of defining what was a green building and how could you measure the performance of a building in terms of energy, indoor air quality, how it dealt with the habitat and stormwater.
So the council came up with a point system. The more a builder does to make a development sustainable, the more points the development gets.
The rating has different levels. Certified, silver, gold, and platinum.
But to get to platinum, you really have to push.
Less than 20, 30 buildings out of 7,000 in the system have achieved platinum at this point.
The Las Vegas City Center is going for LEED silver. That means high-efficiency windows, lots of natural light, reclaimed water for landscaping, and an on-site electric generating plant which uses excess heat to warm the buildings. A gold rating would have required much more. Some things which make sense in the desert, some which don't. And with LEED, it's pretty much one size fits all. MGM Mirage Vice President Gordon Apsher.
I was in a meeting one time on City Center where LEED experts were arguing we should pursue rainwater catch basins. And all of these experts in from all over finally were stopped in their tracks when somebody from Las Vegas said, "Folks, it rains 3 inches a year here. Maybe we should move on and talk about something else."
Another criticism of LEED, it gives the same number of points for minor improvements, like installing bike racks, as it does for putting in a costly, energy-efficient heating and cooling system. And regardless of the point score, you have to prove a building is green. Just the process of getting LEED certification can be cumbersome. Bill Browning again.
Yeah, early on, boy, the to do the documentation, you wound up with an entire bookshelf of documents. It was just horrific.
In fact, City Center has an office just to fill out LEED paperwork. For this huge complex, that might not be a problem. For a smaller developer, the added $20,000 to $30,000 could be significant. But Bill Browning says a buyer needs proof.
I come out of the real estate development industry, and I know how outrageous people claim about buildings and what I'm doing with this and that and the marketing claims and all that. But when you see that plaque on the wall and you see the point score, you know, that's someone else who's done the paperwork and said, yep, they're actually doing that.
So here's what's happening. LEED standards are being rewritten as we speak. Certification is being streamlined and moved online. Other building organizations are writing their own green building standards, and cities and counties across the country are adapting elements of LEED which fit local conditions. Building to LEED Silver Standard at Las Vegas City Center is adding about 2% to upfront construction costs. But MGM Mirage VP Gordon Apsher says energy, waste, and water savings will make that up and more in the long run.
You can make money and do the right thing at the same time.
Right now, building to LEED is voluntary. As costs come down and building codes change, it's possible building green won't be newsworthy, but standard practice. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
Hey everyone, listen up. Grease is the new copper. If you're a thief stealing someone's air conditioner for the copper wiring, that is so 2007. Sucking used fry grease out of the bin behind the Arby's, now that is where it's at these days.
Ew.
Yeah, I know, it's totally gross.
What?
But useful. Raw grease can be rendered into yellow grease and then made into biodiesel. With demand for biodiesel increasing, the market value of this yellow grease has tripled in the last couple of years to 32 cents a pound. That may not sound like a whole lot, but it's about bulk, baby, bulk. In fact, there's been a legitimate grease collection trade for decades now. One of the largest companies involved, it's called Griffin Industries, And they say that, quote, rendering contributes more than $1.5 billion to the GNP annually. So it's been a big business for a long time. There have always been thieves, too, but lately more people are getting into the grease game. We learned about all of this from a report by Ben Arnoldy in the Christian Science Monitor. And when reporters do our homework for us, we call it Ripped Off. From the headlines, Ben is on the line with us now. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Rachel.
Hey, thanks for joining us. So we've characterized this stuff like French fry grease, but give us a few more details. What is this stuff?
Well, it's grease that's collected from restaurants. So whenever they're deep frying something like French fries, it's the leftover gunk in the fry later. And that could be vegetable oil. It could be animal fats.
From any food that's just deep fried.
That's right.
And I understand you visited a rendering plant where this stuff is made into the more valuable yellow grease. Explain that particular adventure. It sounded kind of gross.
Well, before I went, I was talking to a source and said, well, I'm planning to go down to a rendering plant. And they said, oh, do not wear good clothes and wear old shoes you don't care about because the stuff can really smell. And if it gets on you, it's hard to get off.
What does it smell like?
Well, it smells kind of like a combination between a fast food restaurant and a butcher shop where the meat maybe has gone mad, gone bad. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not good. And so when you went to this plant, did you see anything that kind of surprised you?
Well, it's called it was a tallow company. And I don't know if you know what tallow is, but it's scraps of animal fats. So there was some animal parts that I could see, which was kind of gross. But I also, the other thing they do is collect the grease out of the restaurant bins. So the owner there showed me some of the bins that they have, and they're metal bins, and the top cover for a lot of them was bent up.
Hmm.
And that's because they had put locks on the bins, and these thieves, instead of trying to break the lock, they would just bend up the metal of the container and then slip in what they call a stinger, which is the nozzle on a hose, and there's just enough room so that they could sneak the nozzle in and slurp up the fat that's in the bin.
Wow, so they're actually taking it from the rendering facilities as well as the restaurants. Now, the whole thing was pretty much news to us. I had no idea that it was illegal to take this grease. I mean, you would think that this is just waste, that restaurants would actually pay companies to take it away, right?
That surprised me, too. And in fact, for many years, that's the way it worked, that they would have to pay people to come and get it. But because yellow grease is so valuable now, it's usually done for free, or even in some cases, the collectors will pay the restaurants for the grease.
Wow. So they're clearly making a profit. So a legitimate grease collection business like the one we mentioned, Griffin Industries, one of the larger ones, how does it work?
Well, they operate in some 20 states, and they've got drivers who will go around, daily on rounds to pick up grease. And, you know, how often it go to a particular restaurant depends on how much stuff they're frying. But they'll go around with a tanker truck, and they'll vacuum out the grease in each of the bins. And the tanker truck could hold, say, 5,000 gallons of grease, and that's worth several thousand dollars, and companies like Griffin, this is a big business for them, and the theft is so bad that they've actually hired two full-time detectives. One is a former Texas Ranger, and another is a former policeman in San Antonio, and they do nothing but track grease thefts in different states where they operate.
Wow.
Full-time.
It doesn't seem that hard. Just hire a collie if it smells that bad.
Right.
Who are the thieves? What's a profile of a typical grease thief?
Oh, very daring, like Remington Steele, like a cat burglar. He woos the ladies at night and steals the grease by day.
Right. So I asked that question, too. I was really curious. And one of the detectives said, well, they can run. He's dealt with third-generation grease thieves, so this can kind of run in the family. Lately, sometimes it's newcomers who've been attracted. They want to get into this business because, you know, the price has tripled. There's money to be made.
Huh.
But the problem is there's no free grease left. So because they can't always get enough contracts to make a go of it, they'll just go to the bins and steal it.
But then when they try to resell it, don't they get caught?
Well, there are these middlemen who are independent grease collectors who all-time operators will...
Put that on my business card.
Right, a grease middleman. Well, so these middlemen will collect it, and then that sort of obscures the origin of the grease, and then they'll sell it to a rendering company. But the rendering companies are kind of getting smart to this, and oftentimes they won't buy from an independent because they figure, well, this is just stolen grease.
Well, it's, I have to say, a kind of a bizarre story. But, Ben, we're glad you reported on it. We're glad you shared it with us. Ben Arnoldi is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. I will never again go to Arby's and not think twice about all that leftover grease that's left in the back. It's making
right.
fuel.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Ben.
Yep.
You'll still use the horsey sauce liberally, but you'll think about it.
The horsey sauce.
I'm definitely writing this grease screenplay, you know. You could have lines. I mean, the lines just write themselves, right? He's a pretty slick operator. He just slipped through our fingers this time, but we'll get him next time. We're the grease gang.
Oh, my. So we're going to make a little bit of a turn here at the Bryant Park Project. Going from grease thieves, we're going to talk about a more serious story. We're going to talk about aid. And the problems that aid agencies are facing in trying to get much-needed supplies into Myanmar after this weekend's devastating cyclone. We're going to get an update from one agency that operates in the region. That'll be coming up next here on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
And now for some real lost and found sound. That's Philippe Quint, a 34-year-old Russian-born American. He's considered one of the best violinists of his generation. He had the misfortune to forget his instrument. He left it in the back of a Newark taxi cab last month. It was a $4 million Stradivarius. The cab driver returned the 285-year-old violin, and that brings us back to this music. It was performed by Philippe Quint in one of the most unlikely of places. Nancy Solomon reports from New Jersey.
Tucked away near the car rental returns at Newark's airport is a parking lot where hundreds of taxi drivers park their cars, hang out in trailers, and wait for their turn to pick up a customer. But yesterday, on a glorious spring afternoon, this lot became a mini Carnegie Hall. Violinist Philippe Quint showed his gratitude for the return of his violin by giving a private concert for all the airport's cabbies. 100 or so drivers attended the performance, virtually all of them immigrants, and all basking in this one moment of glory. Patrick Casmeus, a Haitian-born driver, says the honor is shared by all cabbies.
We have found cell phone, camera. We return them right away to the office. But this time, $4 million violin, that's a serious issue. And we want the world to know we cab driver in Newark, we're the most honest cab driver in the metropolitan area.
But let's go back to the beginning of this story. How does a guy leave something, anything, worth $4 million in a taxi?
Oh, my God.
Philippe Quint had taken a taxi from the Newark airport to his Manhattan home in the wee hours of April 21st. He'd performed that evening in Dallas, was exhausted, and left the Stradivarius in the cab while he carried his luggage across the street.
I turned to get the violin, but I only saw a cab driving in the distance. I almost fainted, but at the same time, I instantly knew that I had to do something. So I composed myself very quickly and started making a lot of phone calls.
Luckily, the taxi was a minivan, so that allowed workers at the taxi commission to narrow the search to 8 possible cabs. The next day, they found the cabbie, Mohammed Khalil, who discovered the violin untouched in the back of his van.
Oh, he hugged me and he cried and
He can't believe it that he will find it back again.
And that brings us to the concert. As it turns out, the night Khalil accidentally drove away with the violin was his last night of work before retiring from the business.
He was my last customer, and this is it. It's a happy ending for me and a happy ending for him, too.
And not a bad ending for this story, either. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Madeline Brand.